Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Catastrophic flooding and rising food and health costs in Sudan have driven up the number of people in need, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, said on Friday. Authorities declared a three-month state of emergency in early September after the worst flooding in 30 years. To date, more than 860,000 people have had houses destroyed or damaged, and more than 120 have died. Hundreds of schools and thousands of health facilities have also been affected, especially in North Darfur, Khartoum, West Darfur, and Sana'a. The response by UN agencies and partners has reached more than 400,000 people so far, with shelter and essential items for more than 180,000 flood-affected refugees and around 1.9 million internally displaced people and communities. Amid growing needs, surging inflation, reaching nearly 170% in August, has caused a shortage of basic commodities and increased prices of some locally sourced supplies by up to 400%. Here's OCHA spokesperson Jens Laker.
In some cases, by the time the procurement process is finalized, the supplies have increased prices so that the original budgets are no longer valid. Agencies have to restart the process from scratch, while there's no guarantee that by the time that that process is done, the prices will not have risen once again and they can start all over.
UN-appointed independent rights experts have urged the Iraqi authorities to investigate the murder of a female human rights defender and the attempted killing of another, targeted simply because they are women. In a joint appeal on Friday, the seven experts also called on Baghdad to ensure that it was safe for everyone who stood up for people's rights in the country. The development follows the deadly shooting in August of Dr. Riam Yacoub and the attempted assassination of Lodia Raymond Albati in Basra. Both rights defenders had led women's marches within the protest movement against corruption and unemployment that began in 2018 in the southern city. Women are a leading force in the human rights community, but as in many countries, they face additional threats simply because they are women, the experts said in a statement. They added that amid war and insecurity, women human rights defenders faced prejudice, exclusion by society and by political leaders, as well as physical attacks, sexual violence, arbitrary detention, enforced disappearance, torture and even death. They said that it was an outrage that women in Iraq have to risk or lose their life to defend human rights, while also calling for an end to the state of impunity that allows these crimes to continue. The UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, has called for urgent action to address the unimaginable horrors faced by migrants attempting to cross the central Mediterranean Sea in search of safety in Europe. The appeal for EU states to adopt a principled approach to migration also calls on them to tackle the shocking conditions that migrants face in Libya, at sea, and when they finally reach Europe. OHCHR highlighted what it called a cycle of violence, whereby people faced deprivation and abuse in Libya, only to be left to drift for days at sea. Often their boats were intercepted dangerously by the authorities and returned to Libya, the UN Rights Office said in a statement, noting that migrants then faced arbitrary detention, torture and other serious human rights violations. The situation has become even more acute amid the COVID-19 pandemic, OHCHR continued, as humanitarian search and rescue vessels have been prevented from heading out to sea, while there is also a lack of access by civil society groups that help migrants. The call follows a week-long UN rights mission to Malta, which engaged with government officials, UN partners, migrant community leaders, civil society organizations, and 76 migrants from 25 different countries. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Kansas to read the New York Times, and that's not true, but it's here, and we have John Grant on the phone, alive.
Hey, he's kicking, yeah.
How you doing? What's the top headline on the New York Times today?
Well, let's see. Hold on. I'm on the editorial page right now. Let's see.
Oh, no, don't do that.
Top. Dateline.
What's the
leaving hospital, Trump minimizes virus risk. It has him up on his Mussolini balcony there with the flags behind him, pulling his mask off up his ear. I don't know if you or Kansans had the opportunity to watch the great theatrical event of Donald Trump leaving Walter Reed Hospital and getting in a SUV to drive 10 feet to get in a helicopter. And then he got in a helicopter and it actually raised up and flew 10 minutes over the city, and we watched that. It was almost like O.J.'s Bronco. We were watching the helicopter.
No.
And then he landed right. Then he landed. Perfect landing. The guy was an ace. He cranked that thing around and flipped it around so it landed perfectly right by the stairs. And then, then Uncle Don walked off the helicopter on his own power. You know, he's quite the man, you know, and walked up the steps. He actually walked up the steps. 74-year-old fat slob walked up the steps, you know, with COVID-19, and then perched right there in front of four flags, which had already been set up for him there, like, as I say, the Mussolini balcony look. And then he stood there, like, firmly. He had his red makeup on already. His hair was combed. You know, he had his hair technologist had already combed his hair. And there he was. He looked like chiseled against the light, the backdrop. And you could see him breathing hard. He was holding his breath and, like,
oh, really?
And he would hold it firmly, his jaw, and he'd salute. And all this stuff, and so the cameras. Then he took, well, before that, he took his mask off. And then, of course, a man who's still got COVID-19, he's actively got it, he left his mask off and walked back into the White House, and there were five or six people hovering around in there. And he was maskless, you know, and we go, oh, my God, Jesus.
Is he infecting more people?
Well, one would presume, you know. It's,
he does.
If I were the janitor and I was, you know, the maid or I was sweeping up, I think I'd avoid him pretty good there. You know?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, well, I mean, it goes around.
But it was a real propaganda theater, you know, you... The man is on the job, you know. That's the theme. You know, they had him signing blank documents in the hospital.
Oh, I heard that.
He's scribbling his signature, and you look, it's a total blank document. It's just a piece of paper.
I heard.
Well, apparently, I learned that Donald Trump likes to watch himself in these, you know, propagandized theatrical moments, like the helicopter exchange and all this kind of stuff. He likes to watch it with the sound off. So he's a very savvy image-oriented person. He understands the power of the image of whatever it is, semiotics and all that kind of stuff. He seems to implicitly understand it. And so, you know, this was organized to make him look like, you know, he's, you know, everything's fine. You know, everything's fine. In fact, he even said, was interesting to me, he went in the hospital, from the hospital, he said that he was learning an awful lot here. He was firsthand. He really was learning a lot about COVID-19, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And that he was going to report back. He was going to tell America all about it. You know, it was almost like, what's his name's book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, you know, the great mythic story about the hero with a thousand faces, about the hero descends from the village into hell and goes through hell and Hades and all this kind of stuff, has all these adventures and learns all this horrible stuff, and then comes out of Hades and returns to the, you know, his village, and then is sort of to educate and improve his village, knowing what he has learned as his little descent into hell. And so, you know, it was almost like Joseph Campbell. It was almost like Trump and his gang had read Joseph Campbell on The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and they were sort of characterizing his little 2-3 day jaunt at the hospital as a descent into hell, and he was going to then educate America about what this COVID is really, you know. And I'm a brilliant person, and I know it more than my doctors, of course. And so here he was going to inform everybody. You know, I have one. I have a leg up on Joe Biden. I've had the disease. I know it now. Ha ha ha! You know. Well, we'll see. You know, we'll see how it goes. You know, because they say, and I don't want to. I've been blabbing a lot here, but they say is that been given, he's probably had pneumonia. You get pneumonia, you get fluid in your lungs from all this, and because they give, that's what they give this dextroamphetamine is a steroid for. It's for fluid in lungs, and apparently they gave him a hell of a wallop of a dose of that. And that's when, at that point, he's then, you know, he says in a tweet that he hasn't felt better for 20 years. Well, one of the side effects of all of that steroids is, one of the side effects is said to be mania and psychosis. So, you know, here, this, the, you know, the, a very narcissistic man is suddenly, oh, haven't felt this good in 20 years, you know, hey, bring on that helicopter, take me home, you know. And but then, you know, reportedly people can really have precipitous falls from these feelings of being, you know, really feeling good, you know, and suddenly things can collapse. Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of, it's not over yet, as his own prevaricating doctor put it, he's not out of the woods yet, you know. So,
well,
Well,
have you ever had any steroids? I've had two once.
No, I don't recall, you know, ever had any seriously, no.
Yeah, they're dangerous. They're very dangerous.
Yeah, one would think, yeah. What did you have steroids for? What,
I had a lung problem like 20 years ago, and I had a round of steroids. They weren't injectable; they were just pills. You know, they were mild compared to what Donnie's getting. Donnie's getting the real stuff. I mean, this is weightlifter caliber, you know, and
right,
you know, and they and you, even with the mild doses I got for that day or two, I thought I was invincible. And but they're very dangerous because that you do come down off of. It's not a head high. It's not a high that. It's really nothing like that. It's basically, it just makes you feel a lot better immediately.
It's a kind of a physical high, then, I guess.
Get up and move around. It you know, opens up the remaining capacity of the lungs to assimilate oxygen in your bloodstream, which is what it's all about. Getting oxygen in your bloodstream. And I didn't have to have oxygen or anything like that. Donnie did, and he covered that up. I mean,
His doctor did. Absolutely.
Well, no. When he initially walked from the White House, his first trip to Walter Reed. When he went to Walter Reed, there was a photograph on YouTube, and I don't think it was I'm pretty sure it wasn't photoshopped. He had a very small hose running to his nose, when he walked to the helicopter, but it was disguised. I mean, it was very hard to see. So Donnie was on oxygen when he went to Walter Reed. That probably was the predecessor. That's what made them decide, you know, you might have to, you know, you have to go to the hospital for this, you know.
Right.
And I'm sure he was doing public PR in his head, you know, of what would this look like. And
sure.
Question. John Phillips of Walter Reed, he's a resident at the Walter Reed Hospital. He's, I don't know, call him a dissident doctor. He's a doctor there. He's the one that the Guardian newspaper, and listeners, I can't encourage you enough to, if you're going to watch Fox News, you need to check out the Guardian newspaper regularly, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Every time you turn, you're surrounded in Kansas by Fox News. I mean, it's radio, television, everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you say, uh-oh, I'm looking at Fox News, I better check the Guardian, you know.
Yeah. You know, balance.
You can do it on your phone. The Guardian had a great article from this doctor at Walter Reed, because we were tuned in. We were loading firewood for the winter, and we came in and took a break Saturday and turned on YouTube, and there it was, Donnie and his Secret Service entourage in there. What do you call it? It's not Air Force One. It's the limousine. And
the limo spin around the block. Yeah, right. Yeah.
There were hot mics and hot cameras with the supporters, and there were people running along beside the car. Well, the police wouldn't let them get too close, of course. They were running along, and the hot mic was, I die for that guy. I love him. I die for that guy. As they're running along with the limousine and the whole entourage. I mean,
they died
like
for
a dozen. He would die for him. He was yelling that out loud. And as the motorcade went back into Walter Reed, and John Phillips, who's Dr. John Phillips, who was the attending physician in Walter Reed, he said it was sheer, quote, insanity, unquote, according to the Guardian.
Wow.
Because he was infecting, because he was inactive, he's actively infectious, and he was. And the Secret Service, their job, they have no choice.
Right. Well, they're supposed to take a bullet for him, you know, and all that nonsense.
Right. Well, they're going to take the bug. They're going to take they were taking bugs for him. He's, you know, he's put dozens. Now it's up to over two dozen people, not even counting the janitors and the maids and the people. He's put over two dozen people into self-quarantine.
Well, you talk about contact tracing, you know, which all over the world is what the scientific element says is the best way to systematically run this thing down. Well, there, you know, that the big lawn meeting where the super spreader event happened for what's her name, Barrett, Judge Barrett. You know, they refused to do any contact tracing with that. They're not asking people, you know, who they saw afterwards and all that kind of thing, and in fact they've apparently asked some people that if you get it and you're, i.e., you're a nobody and nobody cares about you and you're not going to make news, don't report it. Just deal with it, you know. So they want to keep the true extent of the super spreader event really quiet, because it's ultimately really embarrassing and shows what clunkheads they really are about this whole affair. I mean, this woman, this judge, who has already had, she already had COVID-19, and there's even some question about whether, you know, people who have had it can remain, in some sense, spreaders afterwards. nobody's really accused her of that, but that is a possibility, you know, that she could have spread some of it herself. And so just to, for the Senate, McConnell and the Senate and Trump to pursue this hearing with the, you know, Lindsey Graham, the incredible, obnoxious Lindsey Graham leading this Senate hearing. When the Senate is shut down and three Republican senators have come up with this stuff and, you know, they're going to push this through, they insist on it. Talk about absurd. It's just becoming quite absurd. And you wonder how they can.
Amy,
yeah.
Judge Amy. I call her Judge Amy.
Right.
Because when I first heard her voice, I sat back and I thought, wait a minute, this is a. She's going to be on the Supreme Court and she sounds like a 6-year old, you know.
Well, you know, I had the same reaction. She sounds like a Valley girl or something. Yeah, right.
She sounds like a little girl. Yeah.
She does. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of scary.
And, I guess what bothers me is I'm wondering what's her background and what cult she may have been a member of. And and no sooner than I start digging around people of faith, you know, the
uh-huh.
Catholic cult. We have some Catholic cults out here in Kansas, I have to say, and there's some very strange birds. When they started digging around, well, hell, the website started scrubbing,
uh-huh.
you know, taking out the stuff, anything about her. I don't know. I guess it's a cult. It's a small. I don't think it's really recognized. It's sort of like Opus Dei,
right?
You know, and I'm sure they do not like Pope Frankie. You know, they don't like Pope Francis at all.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They were scrubbing it out, and this is a funny thing. This is just like the oxygen tube in his the orange ape's nose. You know, they underestimate the power of the internet. They always continually do,
right.
And that's by far. I mean, all of our great leaders underestimate the power of the media and of the internet, and. There were good reporters who were digging around, and listeners, you can do this. Go to the Internet Archive, and it's called the Wayback Machine. And the Wayback Machine is wondrous. It's almost impossible to believe. But they mm-hmm. save a lot of the web pages, and you could go back to the Catholic group / cult, whatever you want to call them. People of praise, and you can still see what they scrubbed out of the web page.
Uh-huh.
The reporters.
Yeah, I read about
that.
What's it called? People of Praise? What was it?
I think it's called that. I might be wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I read about that.
They scrubbed her name out of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can go to the Wayback Machine at theinternetarchive.org, and there are reporters who've already done that. I think it's The Guardian that did it once
mm-hmm.
again. That said, oh, look at here's what they're erasing from the history, her history.
Right. Yeah.
And I think there's a lot more to Judge
right.
Amy than we know. Her having the
right.
bug, COVID-19,
right.
It's probably indicative. I have a buddy who's a bar hound. He claims he's had it twice.
Really?
And
okay.
He's in Kansas City. I don't see him that much. You
uh-huh.
know, but
uh-huh.
he got it the first time and almost. I mean, he really was. He was almost a phone call away from having an ambulance come get him.
Yeah.
And he grunted through it, and then he got it again, less than 3 months. And it wasn't as bad on him as it was before, but he said he doesn't wish it on anybody. Of course,
yeah.
he hasn't stopped going to the bar. He hasn't stopped going to the bars.
Yeah.
But I mean, he was like going to, and he's like maybe 40, mid 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And he said if he was like Donnie's age or a lot of our great leaders, you know,
right.
ages, he would, he said, you'd think that these idiots would realize that this stuff is dangerous. This bug is dangerous as hell. And,
especially if you're, you know, 74, you have a mild heart condition, you're overweight.
Yeah.
And plus you're stressed out with this, all this electioneering and whatnot.
This guy has no work routine, and he's as fit as a fiddle. He's 45 or 46.
Yeah, versus Donald Trump.
Takes good care of himself. He thinks he's bulletproof or bug-proof, you know.
I think of Donald Trump. I'm a literary person. I studied literature, and you know, the idea of tragedy really, really works for me as a very real thing in life. You know, Aristotle's idea of tragedy. You know, the idea of, you know, Hamlet and Macbeth and all the great play tragedies. The idea that the tragedy is the person dies at the end in the theater. And you know, they're doomed by their own decisions and by their own actions and by things they've done in Act One and Act Two and all that. You know, it's a sort of inexorable sort of thrust arc towards the end of the tragedy. Well, I really do see Donald Trump, the man, in that light. I mean, to me, He's got himself in this tragic arc that somehow he's going down. Now his base, no doubt, don't see it that way. They would, as this one gentleman said, he'd give his life for him. But you know, I would suggest there's some hallucination going on there, as delusion and whatnot. You know that. But if you look at this man's story, if you will, and you look at the position he's carved out for himself now, where he's still, as the guy said, not out of the woods of this very tricky disease, as your 45-year-old gentleman friend would say, you don't wish this on anybody. And this thing, you know, the surprises you can get, and here they've pumped him all up with all these, you know, health-enhancing drugs and cocktails for a 74-year-old obese man with a minor heart condition, and with tremendous stress, to throw him back in the White House, less than a month from one of the more amazing elections in the American history. And for him to try to get back into that game while he's still sick, I mean, talk about the stress level on this man, on this human being, Donald Trump, to try to sustain this idea that everything is just fine, you know, when it's not, you know, and the stress of trying to, you could see it when he was standing there on the balcony, you know, breathing but holding his breath, with a jaw out. He'd practice this Mussolini look. And, you know, it's so artificial that, you know, the seeds of collapse are in his nature now. It's just, I mean, how long can this guy hold out with this fiction that everything's just fine, I've never felt better, you know, and let's go get Joe Biden, you know, the weak man Joe Biden. It's watching a guy on a tightrope, you know, and you're wondering, when is he going to, you know, fall off? You know, I don't know. You know, that's my look, you know, that's how I see it. Now maybe he'll has nothing to do with that at all, and it's all in my mind as a perceiver. And, you know, he'll win the election and become the greatest president ever, and, you know, we'll have, like, busts of him throughout history, and I don't know.
Well,
you know.
Well.
So,
statistically,
it's interesting. Well, I mean, we live in interesting times. You know what I mean?
Well, I've been saying that for 3 years, but now I'm beginning to think we're living. I think we live in extraordinary times because of the.
I agree.
You call it tragedy. I call it irony. I think it's
lots of that. Yeah,
supremely ironic that so many of his followers that I see. When I rarely get out of the 10 acres
and
go out, I'm counting, I'm looking, I'm who's wearing masks at stores, we had an abysmal start here. I mean, in terms of nobody at the beginning, nobody was wearing masks at all, except the people who had to work, except people who had to work for a living. The grocery store clerks, the people
The working counter. Class people, and you know, they got to pay the rent.
The important people who had to work, they would wear their masks if they had to at their jobs, you know.
Right.
And I respected that, so you know, out of that, I would wear a mask. You know?
Of course.
I confess, there was a couple times I just jumped out of the car, didn't even think about it.
Right.
And ran into the liquor store and got me my beer and then ran back in. But I never went into these stores if they were busy. If they were real busy, I wouldn't go in. Mm-hmm. Then I started noticing that nobody was wearing masks except the clerks. And I said, fuck this. I'll put on a mask if I have to go in. And you get tired of sitting in the parking lot waiting for your chance to go in when there's no one around, you know.
Right.
And, so I've been wearing my mask. Well, I went out this morning and I noticed that even the clerks at the now the grocery store still wears their masks. The people that have to work for a living there. But here at the convenience store I went to get some gasoline, nobody was there. And they were all young people. I think that were running behind the counters. And I think what's going on, the COVID numbers here in the county. Jefferson County are going up. We've had 4 deaths so far, which is unheard of.
Wow.
And both of them were 70 and 80 year old people. 2 of them were women. I guess 2 were men. So, but that's a very low percentage. And it's like a very slow moving wildfire.
Yeah.
And I think it's just hitting here, and people don't get it that they're spreading it to other weaker people. They're not less people. They're just people. They're old, or they have I have pre-existing conditions and stuff. And I'm just like they're not considerate at all of other people, and they get it into this machismo, and it's not
right.
Shocked today. The first time I saw people wearing masks that weren't. Workers at the stores were these older women. I was very impressed with that. That the older women were the first ones to wear masks in public.
Mm. And, well, you know, I think you're onto something. And there was a couple of very strange stories in the paper yesterday about this kind of stuff. You know, that there were people in the White House that thought, oh God, you know, maybe this guy will wake up and maybe this will. You know, we'll jack up a little empathy in the man, and maybe he'll come out of it saying, you know, with a little humility, oh yeah, this is pretty serious stuff. We got to work with this, and that empathy will appear in this whole equation on this fella. But no, exact opposite. You know, the same predictable nonsense is his behavior. But I think empathy is at the core of it. It's like that. You know, people who know this, Dr. Fauci, et cetera, you know, you wear a mask for 2 reasons. One, you wear it to protect yourself a bit, but you mostly wear it to protect everybody else, you know, from you, from breathing out. So you're not breathing out. Your breath is caught by this fabric and whatnot, and you know the little particles get stuck in the fabric. Now, that, to me, is a factor of empathy. You're empathizing with everybody else in that grocery store that you're walking to get your eggs and milk and all that stuff. And that you're actually considering other people, which in the world of Donald Trump and his base, the idea of thinking about other people is socialism. You know, it's communism or something, you know, that empathy and considering other people is a weakness. And
I think you're onto something big time here.
Yeah.
And I think
it's a little philosophical approach on that, but I think there is something to that. Yeah.
First time I ran into that was in the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
When I really didn't understand what the hell was going on. Of course, I was young, and it was when I ran into this group. And it's fire. In the aftermath of the Vietnam War, I began paying attention to nuclear weapons, how many there were. And out here, and this movie, The Day After, came out, starring James Robart.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of it was filmed in Kansas. Really, a lot of it was filmed in Kansas. And it sort of brought me back awake again about the there was this group called Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Absolutely, I know them.
And I had never heard of the group, and I got to know them being married to a doctor, you know. And I started watching, and I realized those two words, social responsibility, are big. I mean, they're words that if you think about it. And I was back then. I smoked like a chimney. I didn't care. I thought, the libertarian in me, I would go in and smoke cigarettes in the restaurants, you know. And I never, you know, I didn't. I would do it even if they said no smoking. I would smoke cigarettes in the restaurant.
Right.
And I was thinking like individualist libertarian rather than thinking, you know, that's my right to, you know.
Right. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
But I began realizing about social responsibility. I don't want to be responsible for giving these people a boost in the restaurant away from me cancer because they are sensitive and living with a doctor. She patiently, and believe me, she has more patience than I do. She tried to explain that you know it's not we're infringing on your rights.
Right.
She used it as she hates Ralph Nader only because I mean she respects Ralph Nader, but when I met her she was anti Nader. I guess Nader messed up an election for I don't know.
Yeah, I think he might have the 2000 election he might have had something to do with it.
Well, I think it predates that because she was on. But here's one thing she pointed out about to the betterment of Nader's reputation, because she wore seatbelts from the day I met her, even if I wouldn't, she would put her seatbelts on, and she tried. And this goes with this thing of social responsibility.
Yep.
And she also insisted when I rode my motorcycle that I wear a helmet.
Right.
And it comes from the point of view for her as a healthcare worker. It came from the point of view, because I do respect working people more than I do almost anybody. Mm-hmm. And I began to realize what kind of problems us libertarian-type people cause. Mm-hmm. We don't wear motorcycle helmets, and we make the workers at the hospital work a lot harder if you got...
A friend of mine did that, and the attention everybody has to pay to you because you fucked up and banged up your head so bad that you're a vegetable,
you didn't wear a seatbelt, or you didn't wear a seatbelt in your car, and you hit your head on the windshield, or you rolled around, or you turned into a floating bomb inside the car. When the car rolls, your body flies all over the place, injuring other people in the vehicle.
Injuring other people, and you didn't do enough to kill yourself, and now they got to take care of you with all this super duper.
Right.
Did you
go to the hospital?
Yeah, absolutely.
Bruises on your instead of just bruises on your body when you were drunk and rolled the car, you know, you've got broken bones and you've hurt other people inside the car because your body just flew all over the place inside the capsule of the cockpit of the car. And then you go out and go to a restaurant and you insist on smoking cigarettes in the booth right there next to a bunch of other people who probably are sensitive. Maybe they have a history of cancer in their families, and you could very well trigger a cancer in those people's or emphysema or asthma.
Something.
Social responsibility.
Amen.
It took a whole new meaning with me when you had to consider healthcare workers and what they have to put up.
Well, I think this is the basis for this socialism bugaboo. You know, the idea of, you know, I mean, Joe Biden, they cranked somebody up at this town hall last night. I think it was last night. In Miami, to ask him about socialism, and he said, you know, he made the case, look, I'm not a socialist or communist, I'm the farthest thing from it. And of course he's not a socialist or communist at all. I mean, the guy's, you know, totally centrist to the max. But the core of that idea, I think, is social responsibility. Are you your brother's keeper in a way, if you want to use that kind of religious stuff? I mean, do you have some responsibility for a social contract where you exhibit empathy and care for other people around you? All for the betterment of society, so, you know, that you have a society that works instead of a society where it's me, 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 fuck you, and I exploit you for everything I can to get ahead and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Only the strong survive, might
be right. Social Darwinism, that's a whole thing, a philosophy that people have written about, and Donald Trump exhibits a social Darwinism totally.
I think he was raised
that way by a slumlord father who, you know, didn't have an ounce of empathy himself, you know,
got busted at a KKK riot in New York.
Right. Yeah. And then, of course, one of his mentors was, you know, the most loathsome toad scumbag in New York history, Roy Cohn, you know, the unbelievably disgusting homosexual lawyer that died of AIDS.
Well, now, wait a minute.
Well, nothing against
his
homosexuality.
He denied being a homosexual right up until
he may have denied it, but it was an open secret that Roy Cohn was a flaming homosexual. And Roy Cohn... I saw a documentary about him. He would appear at these bars in Provincetown, you know, a big gay hangout in Massachusetts, and he would appear at these bars with these what they call rent boys, I guess you call them, and he's having sex with these men when he's got AIDS, and he would have unprotected sex with these men according to the story.
Yeah, see.
And you know, because he had no empathy, he didn't give a shit about these people. You know, all he wanted to do is, pardon the expression, get his rocks off, I guess. You know, and you know, this is to me an exhibit of, you know, it's kind of off color, I grant you, discussing this stuff clinically, but here's a man, Roy Cohn, who made his name from refusing empathy for anybody and being a prick to the end, and he was good at it. He was brilliant. The man was brilliant. He was Barbara Walters, was dating him for a while, you know, as a cover and all this stuff.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's sordid upper fancy life, you know.
Yeah.
And but you lift the rug on Roy Cohn and you say, wow, wow, wow. And this is a guy that mentored Donald Trump. And, of course, when Roy Cohn developed AIDS very publicly, you know, Donald Trump would never speak to him ever again. Because
isn't
obviously
that weird?
He became a liability in that sense.
Right.
And you look at this, these are the people that formed this man, you know. And the worst thing that you can show is empathy or give a damn about somebody who doesn't necessarily worship you, you know, just anybody, you know what I mean?
John, do you think it also has to do with his view of illness being sick
mm-hmm.
as being a weakness? I think you're right.
I think you're right. Yeah. Well, this is very interesting. One thing that I understand about Donald Trump, because I just went through this exact cycle. I was in a hospital. You know, I had open chest surgery. And, you know, usually you're in the ICU for 5 days and then they keep you for like a week and a half. It was, I spent 3 nights in a hospital and I told them, I want the fuck out now. You know, this is a zoo. It's driving me nuts. Television all night long. I can't sleep. You know, I'm asking for pain drugs simply to hit me in the head with a rubber hammer to put me asleep. This is a zoo. Let me out. And they finally heard me, and they did. They let me out because a doctor later told me, well, we let you out because you're a good patient and we trust you that you're going to do what we say when you get home, you know. And so I really empathize. Again, I'm empathizing here, you know, sympathizing with Donald Trump who wants to get the hell out of Walter Reed. I get it. Yes, I get it. And so my wife and I have this sort of issue. She'll get a cold or something, and it feels to me like, you know, she goes into a different realm of being, if you will. Like I'm healthy and then I'm sick. It's a whole different place. And I sort of refuse that distinct border, you know. It's like we're always sick or healthy, you know, and it's always a constant, no matter what, you know, you're struggling. And so I think Donald Trump is like that. You know, he won't succumb to, well, I'm sick now, I'm officially sick, I have to act like this, you know. Instead, he's saying, no, it's more important to me that I project this Mussolini look or whatever I'm supposed to be projecting, and that's more important to him than his disease. But, you know, the body is still the body. And, you know, I was in the hospital for one of my post-op visits with some doctor, and he's looking at the computers, and I realize, my God, they have an encyclopedia of John Grant's heart rates, pressures, God damn, for like five, you know, it's like, look at this crap. It goes on and on and on and on, you know?
Yeah.
And every time they took liquid out of me, every time I peed, I reported it, you know, it's all there. And so I said to the guy, you know, it's just, I'm a writer, you know, and, you know, I write about myself, essays, memoirs, or whatever, you know, and that's me, if you will. But I'm looking at this encyclopedia of data, but that's also me, too, you know? And I'm going, like, which is really me? All these bloody numbers that tell me the fluid levels and this qualities, you know, they put this thing on your finger, and they tell you your oxygen level in your blood through the capillaries and the tip of your finger. And I realize this is the big deal with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Well, did it fall below 94? Did it get down to 90 into the 80s? Oh, my God, you know. And mine was the guy just took it this morning in my porch. I'm 98. That's good. That's good. But you get down to 94, 92, whoa, something's going on here, you know? And this is what they're watching with Trump, and this is what they won't tell us, what that little number from that machine they stick on the end of your finger is, you know? And so, as I say, this encyclopedia of all these numbers that are on some level, from a doctor's point of view, this is the life of John Grant. You know, he's like a meat puppet in there, and that's all they care about is these numbers. You know what I mean? God damn, the meat puppet's numbers are going down here. We better do something about that. Well, but then again, I have my own, you know, image as a writer and whatnot, and Donald Trump is president. Right. He has his own image of what he wants to do. And so you can see the struggle. And but, you know, what his life looked like, what his life looked like from those, that collection of numbers is what many people are asking. And I think, you know, the American public has the right to know some of that, but they aren't getting it.
Right. Well, it's anything to avoid Mike Pence.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Well, we have a debate, tomorrow between Harris and Pence.
Oh, yeah. Where is that at? You know? Where are they going?
I forget. It may be in the Midwest someplace, yeah. Out near
Arizona?
You, probably. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it's that far west. I think it's, I don't recall. But anyway, it's somewhere in the Midwest.
I guess they're going to.
Harris has lobbied for a plexiglass separating spit window there. So if Mike Pence spits at her, it'll get stuck on the plexiglass.
Hey! Here's the plexiglass. I mean, at the convenience store I went to, they put plexiglass. You know,
right.
I'm sort of like, well, you know, that's a good deal because this big fat kid who probably just right out of high school is getting my stuff behind the counter, and I was like, oh, I'm sort of glad that, and he's not wearing a mask.
Oh,
and I'm like going, I'm sort of glad that they had that plexiglass.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole industry now in plexiglass, I think. It's a good industry to go into. Plexiglass.
Well, I've lived in many ghettos, and we had plexiglass in the ghettos from the get go because they were always worried about getting robbed. You know,
sure.
Close the bolts down. So,
right. Yeah, you got inch and a half thick plexiglass in that case.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, well, I'm trying to figure out what Donnie is. I think what Donnie's doing is he's on his. He had to come out. His niece married. There's a great article in the Guardian. I'm pretty sure it's the Guardian, and it's Mary Trump came out after Donnie went to the Walter Reed.
Right.
And she explained it. She watched it. She watched what the men in the Trump family were like as a young girl.
Sure.
And she pointed. One of the searing effects on her memory was her grandmother. That would be Donnie's mother.
Right.
Donnie's mother had acute osteoporosis, and she was in a lot of pain all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when she came out of the hospital, Donnie and Freddie, his dad mm-hmm. and son, they basically just blew her off. And as a matter of fact, she became, really, after she came back from the hospital, she became a non-entity. You can read the interview, listeners, Mary Trump's latest talking about how the men in her family not only viewed illness as a weakness, being ill was a weakness, but also you became a persona non grata. You became not really you weren't a human anymore because you were sick and you were in pain. And now this woman, Mary Trump, the niece of Donnie, has a PhD in clinical psychology, so she's not stupid about this.
She is as smart as whip. Plus, she has some kind of degree in comparative literature. So, you know, she's a clinical psychologist, understands, but she also understands storytelling and literature and things like that. So Mary Trump is quite an individual in my view, and especially having the sensibility to see what Fred and his son, his favorite son Donald, how they must have treated his wife mother when she came home out of the hospital, because Mary Trump's father, I think, was it Robert? Is that his name? I forget. He was the older one.
Her father was named Fred Trump Jr.
Okay, but was he the one that was the pilot?
Yeah, well, he became a pilot to get away from the family.
Right,
but he
also had a drinking problem and died quite young. And apparently, he was ostracized from the family, you know, because he didn't want to participate in that. He became a pilot instead of a real estate pirate, you know, kind of thing. And you know, if you didn't want to play real estate piracy, slumlord piracy, and that sort of thing, you know, the family ostracized you. And the way she suggests is with the mother coming out of the hospital, no sensitivity whatsoever to her. And she was just relegated to the corners. And, I mean, a really, really cold-blooded family, obviously. And, you know, and they talk about his father being the slumlord and how the son, you know, took a grand leap and took that whole psychology into Manhattan for really, really, you know, elite big real estate dealings, which, you know, he's of course famous for. But that a lot of what he did is like three card Monte. It's like, you know, keep your eye on the ball here because you're going to lose it. It's a con job. And, you know, he's good at that. And he's good at manipulating his way out of bankruptcy. In other words, when he hits bottom and it's, you know, it seems you're doomed, he's good at slipping out of that with some success. And, of course, you could say that's where he's at right now. And arguably he's in a bankrupt situation and he's denying it and he's still doing is trying to do his magic. And as I say, I'm not kidding. This is the way I see it. And as a narrative, as a story, and I see tragedy as the inevitable end here. And it's we'll wait and see. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll turn out to be a happy ending here somehow. I don't know.
No, there's no happy ending with this.
I don't think there is a happy ending to this one. Yeah.
I mean, we're at 213,000 dead people in America, in this country alone, over a million. And we're the worst by far per capita. We have more fatalities than any other country in the world.
And plus, what, we're cooking on a depression worse than the 30s, and we have anger, racial anger in the streets, and, you know, we in bad state here, you know.
It's a time, I think, ripe for change, and I think a lot of people know that they want that. They realize it needs to be changed, but it's not the change they voted for 4 years ago. 4 years ago, they voted for change too. But I think Donnie's failed miserably on every policy point he's raised, and it's largely because of his, you know, complicity with the billionaires in the military industrial complex. I mean, he thinks that's cool because he's dumb. He was a dumb, spoiled kid before we elected him, and he's still a dumb, spoiled kid.
Well, he's really dumb in certain respects. But Howard Gardner, a famous psychologist, wrote books about the idea that there are many kinds of intelligences. So he may be dumb as a board in a lot of areas, but he has a certain brilliance and charm and energy that, frankly, you know, is quite unhealthy.
where he's smart is not what things make him smarter.
Yeah.
They're smart rattlesnakes. There's smart bulls. Yeah,
right.
There's smart bears. There's smart bears.
Yeah. All right, Mike.
All right. The New York Times via John Grant.
Here for the New York Times.
Let's hear it for the gray lady and John Grant. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mike. Take care. See you later.